640 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Remnants of Debbie are still impacting the Northeast and causing some terrifying moments, like for this woman in Rochester, New
York. My house got surrounded by water, like muddy, roily water, and I called 911 for them to come and get me, and they said they were sending somebody, and they never came, and I thought I was going to die.
While the storms have been the story in the east, destructive wildfires still rage out west. And CBS's Ben Tracy tells us there are big concerns about the millions of people breathing in the smoke.
A new study shows exposure to wildfire smoke increases risks of dementia more than other air pollution.
An Israeli airstrike hit a school that was being used as a shelter in Gaza. Hamas claims as many as 100 were killed. CBS's Remy Innocencio reports from Tel Aviv.
Israel is strongly disputing Hamas's estimate of the total number of dead and said it used precise munitions in this strike to try to minimize harm to civilians. Hamas, for its part, denies it ever uses civilian buildings like schools and hospitals. And this latest strike comes just after Israel agreed to restart ceasefire talks with Hamas to be held on August 15th, this Thursday, in conjunction with the U.S. and the mediator countries of Qatar and Egypt.
No one survived a plane crash in Brazil yesterday. Here's CBS's Chris Van
Cleve. The ATR-72, a turboprop popular with regional carriers, was traveling from Cascavel to Sao Paulo. Flying at 17,000 feet, it was nearing the airport when the apparent stall occurred.
Today, Vice President Harris will be campaigning in Las Vegas while former President Trump is holding fundraisers in Wyoming. Both candidates are talking border security.
A recent CBS News poll found a majority of voters think border crossings would increase if Harris wins and decrease under Trump, who's promised mass deportation.
We are going to start the largest mass deportation in the history of our country.
That kind of language is one reason Mesa, Arizona's mayor, a Republican, says he's supporting Harris.
If we did resort to mass deportation, that would crash our economy.
That's correspondent Bradley Blackburn. It's the final 2 days of competition at the Paris Olympics, and the two biggest games everyone will be watching. Team USA women's soccer plays Brazil today, and men's basketball, it's the U.S. versus France in Paris for the gold. And then tomorrow, you get the women's basketball team playing in the finals, also against France. This marks the very first Olympics ever where the same countries are playing in the gold medal game to win it all for both the men's and women's basketball. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. There are new standards for livestock to be USDA certified organic, but as Deborah Van Fleet reports, it'll be a while before they're required.
Those raising livestock will have to observe the new standards by January 2029 at the latest. Sentient Science reporter Seth Milstein says some of the changes under the new standards may surprise shoppers who choose certified organic meat and poultry out of concern for the animals.
There were various procedures that were just flat out banned in the new standards. Tail docking of cows and gestation crates and farrowing cages for pigs or toe clipping chickens. This is stuff that animal welfare activists have been pushing for a while.
Milstein stresses these standards affect only producers with a USDA organic certification, which is voluntary. Among the categories are the amount of indoor and outdoor space required, poultry stocking densities, and physical alterations and euthanasia. Milstein maintains that certifications by the nonprofits A Greener World and Certified Humane reveal more about how the animals were raised than the USDA certification.
If you want to shop consciously with a mind towards animal welfare approved is generally recognized as the most stringent, the highest standards for the animals. Certified Humane is good as well. It's not quite as good, but good.
Milstein says labels can be confusing and even misleading and encourages people who rely on them to do some research. He points to egg labels as a prime example.
Interesting case is pasture raised, which has no legal regulations and essentially means nothing except If it says certified humane pasture raised, that's a very high standard. Cage-free eggs, there's like three different certifications for that.
I'm Deborah Van Fleet. This story was produced with original reporting by Seth Milstein for Sentient Media.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine today, highs in the mid-70s, mostly clear tonight, a low around 58. Sunny with a high in the upper 70s on Sunday. 61 Sunday night, partly sunny, 78 the high for Monday. For Tuesday, sunshine with highs near 80 degrees. Right now, it's 58.
Earl Ingram.
Tune into the next show. It's Motown Monday. We'll react to the news from the weekend and talk about the issues impacting us all. You won't want to miss it.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
You're listening to The Shaw at WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review here on Civic Media. And my name is Jim Santel, your host for this, our second hour of our weekly weekend wrap-up of all things rule of law related, justice related. Lots of focus today on the courts, as it always is an appropriate focus of our national, our state, our worldwide attention. Going to spend some time talking more about what's going on in our courts here in America, and then also spending some time in this hour chatting with what's going on in Venezuela and Thailand, Britain and Bangladesh. People protesting, most often peaceably, but not always. We're going to talk about the things that are prompting those protests, the results of them, the uncertain results of them coming out of those nations, and the lessons we learn, even with in the midst of those uncertain results as of this time. But we're staying right now in the state of Arizona, where the attorney general there, her name is Chris Mayes. She is prosecuting this fake elector case, alleging election interference by these fake electors and others, including Rudy Giuliani and also Mark Meadows. Along the way, she has said that she is going to be vigorously prosecuting the case, and indeed, she apparently is doing just that. She said that just this past week, she has secured a first cooperation deal. That is a defendant coming forward and saying, I will now provide you with information about what I know related to election interference in Arizona. She announced that as the attorney general, that Jenna Ellis, you recall, she's a lawyer who played this major role in Donald Trump's efforts to remain in power. We saw her a lot on television, has agreed to testify with the attorney general there in Arizona against other defendants also named in that case. She's going to come in and she's going to provide information, presumably in non-public interviews, non-public proceedings before a grand jury, telling those law enforcement authorities and those fact finders what it is she knows. Very significant, a cooperation agreement. You know as well that Jenna Ellis had previously pled guilty in the Georgia case. In the Georgia case, that case brought by Fannie Willis in Fulton County, also alleging election interference. And she reached a similar cooperation deal with the prosecutors there. So this is the second time now that Jenna Ellis has not completely resolved her matters, but is nonetheless moving in that direction. And then beyond that Ellis disposition or partial near disposition there in Arizona, a second cooperation agreement became public. A woman named Lorraine Pellegrino. She is a fake elector. She's one of the people who got together and signed these documents that said, yes, indeed, I'm an elector. I'm voting in favor of Donald Trump, when in fact the successful candidate in Arizona was and is, remains, Joe Biden. She pleaded guilty. She pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor there in Arizona, a charge of filing a false instrument, which is a document, an item of some kind, and she's going to avoid jail time as a result of that. The agreement with the prosecution is you plead guilty and admit what you have done, and also, of course, cooperate with us, like Jen Ellis. Tell us what you know. Tell us more about those other fake electors who are still on the obviously, clearly defense list as of this time. Tell us more about that, and we'll agree not to recommend any jail time, any sentence of incarceration for you. Pellegrino is a Phoenix area activist. She also acted as secretary of the Arizona Fake Electors, a major player in all that, so she knows what she's talking about and presumably can give the attorney general and other law enforcement authorities some significant insight into what exactly happened over and above the charges set forth in that indictment. Those are significant because while several of the fake electors have reached cooperation agreements in other states, Pellegrino, Lorraine Pellegrino, appears to be the first to plead guilty to a criminal charge, a major significant event here in America. In Michigan, you may recall that this fellow named James Renner, he's a former state trooper there, had all charges dropped last year after he also agreed to cooperate. His deal, his arrangement, he cooperates and the government agrees, the state attorney general dismisses the case against him. In Georgia, this omnibus, very sweeping indictment, many, many defendants, more than half of the 16 Republicans who acted as fake electors in that case have struck immunity deals with Fannie Willis, basically in exchange for not going ahead with the prosecution against them, coming in and cooperating with the government. The district attorney, Fulton County, again, confirming those arrangements with respect to the charges that she brought there more than a year ago through the grand jury process. So a lot of this moving ahead, fake electors moving ahead in not only in Arizona, but also obviously in Georgia, Michigan, other places around our nation. We'll keep on top of all of that because it is significant as all of these cases continue to march through our process, admittedly slowly, admittedly without disposition in all matters, in the major matters, but nonetheless, justice moving forward in the courts of these various judges. So we anticipate, we expect that all of these judges, whether it is the judge who are presiding over cases like fake electors, the more broadly articulated charges of election interference, all of them, we expect from all of them ethics. We expect them to behave in a way that ensures that their focus, their exclusive focus, is applying the law to the facts and the facts to the law, to ensure that their own personal interests out there do not implicate, do not affect their decisions, that if they have biases or prejudices of any kind, if they've got relationships with parties who are appearing before them, that they should recuse themselves, take themselves off these cases when it's appropriate to do so. And indeed, judges and justices around the country do that routinely. Members of our Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, do that. Not with great frequency, but when they do have conflicts of interest, they do it. We know Ketanji Brown Jackson recused herself just this past term in one of the two cases involving this major decision to overturn Chevron. And so it happens on a regular basis. State court judges, federal judges look around and say, you know what? I've got an interest in this particular matter. I shouldn't be handling it. There is an appearance of impropriety. I shouldn't be involved in making the decision on this. Indeed, the motion in front of Judge Juan Merchan, in which he is alleged to have some bias, also proceeds upon that basis. He will analyze that and determine whether or not any of the allegations that the defense makes as to him are sufficiently meritorious to warrant his recusal. He probably won't do that. He's addressed those things before and chosen not to do so. Also there in that case, he made reference to an administrative judicial authority in the state of New York who certainly looked at the situation and said, you know what, no reason for you, Judge Merchan, to get yourself off the case. But all these things, we provide them with standards and articulate the mechanisms by which they should determine whether or not they remain on these cases. All the more reason why the most important case in our land, the most important cases in our land, presented to the highest court in our land, should likewise be subject to and be the result, the deliberative result of an ethics code. And that's the kind of thing that, again, members of the legislature, the president of the United States of America advocating for that as well, Sheldon Whitehouse in the Senate, members of the House of Representatives asking for the establishment, the legislative creation of a code of ethics that not only provides standards for the Supreme Court justices to behave, but also enforcement mechanisms. We know that just recently, one of the proposals from sitting Associate Justice Elena Kagan has been that the Chief Justice appoint a panel, a group of lower federal court judges from appeals courts, from trial courts who have good reputations, who are academic, who know what they're doing, who are experts in their area. Appoint them and make them the arbiters, make them the deciding officials when it comes to what cases should be recused, what cases the judges can continue to review. And so it leads to an assessment, an evaluation of how we got here. How did this all come about? It's important to recognize that this is not a small matter. And the focus on ethics is appropriate for all of the judges, including people like Tanya Chutkan and Juan Merchan and Aline Cannon and Scott McAfee and hundreds of other judges, thousands of judges across our nation. All of this underscored again when just this past week, more information came out through the offices of a sitting senator. His name is Ron Wyden. He produced information that Clarence Thomas, an associate justice of the Supreme Court, had once again failed to disclose that he took some flights along with his wife, Virginia, between Hawaii and New Zealand back in 2010, admittedly 14 years ago, but not previously disclosed, at the sponsorship and at the financial support of mega donor Harlan Crow. Harlan Crow having at least one case pending in front of the Supreme Court. A private jet, apparently owned and operated by Harlan Crow, takes Clarence Thomas and his wife on this flight between Hawaii and New Zealand back in 2010, adds to the list of other things that are also in the category of luxury travel on behalf of and through the auspices of Harlan Crow. We know that all this began way back in April of 23, when Justice Clarence Thomas, according to the reporting, accepted gifts and some luxury travel from Harlan Crow for years without disclosing it as federal law requires. Now, he has come back, that is the justice, and amended some of those reports significantly. He did not do it promptly, and even this latest reporting does not show up in those amended reports. He did disclose some of those trips on his financial disclosure forms, and some of that only happened after the Senate Judiciary Committee, led by Senator Dick Durbin, revealed that in June of 2023, uncovering even more trips that the justice took between 2017 and 2021, Harlan Crow sponsored that he did not disclose. The luxury trips, regrettably, are not the only gifts and other controversial dealings that Justice Thomas has had with Harlan Crow. The mega donor, this real estate owner, this magnate, if you will, reportedly also purchased Georgia real estate from Thomas way back in 2014, 10 years ago, including the home where Clarence Thomas's mother lived, and paid for Thomas's grandnephew's private tuition, all that coming through Harlan Crow. We know as well that with respect to Sam Alito, these major events reported earlier this year, not so very long ago, involving flag flying. Alito flew an inverted flag after the 2020 election outside his home in suburban Washington, D.C. Again, a lot of reporting at the time, a photograph of that, publishing up an image in the New York Times of the flag flying on January 17th of 2021. At the same time that the High Court, the Supreme Court, including Sam Alito, was considering a 2020 election-related offense, a case matter there in front of him at that very time. And more matter items related to flag flying. All of that related to this concern about ethics as we continue to review all of this on Amicus Law Review and talk more in our broadcast all about ethics for our judges and justices.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
At Fleet Farm, we know every opening day doesn't begin and end with us. But if it did, we've got you covered. Everyday hunting gear from Winchester, Remington, and Bear. Everyday fishing gear from Daiwa, St. Croix, and Rapala. Everyday yard cleanup from Scott's, Fiskars, and AgriFab. Whatever makes your day, we're right there with you. At Fleet Farm, we've got everything you need for everyday life.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Law Review, and in this, our second hour on our weekend broadcast, talking about the reasons why we're so concerned about judicial ethics, what prompted all of this factually, based upon reliable reporting, and why it is important for judges, justices, not to be involved in cases in which they have personal interests. They know the individuals who are appearing in front of them. They've taken gifts, trips, travel, all kinds of things. They've got some other interest in the outcome of the cases, why that's all important. Why? Because it ensures the integrity of the matters as they are decided. And therefore, the public, in accepting these decisions, controversial though they may be, has a reason to believe that they're based not upon bias, but upon a decision by the judges or justices, the application of rules of law to the facts of the case. Discussing some of these things that have been before the Supreme Court in particular, earlier this year, this very notorious, this famous incidents, plural, of Justice Alito flying a flag over his home in suburban Washington, D.C. Same time, considering a 2020 election-related case, that flag inverted, and reporting that the flag alarmed neighbors, and some of them reported this to the Supreme Court, and that flag, again, in some of the public understanding of it, is support for those people who would believe that the 2020 election was stolen. When that flag appears inverted over the Supreme Court justice's home there in suburban Washington, D.C., reason to believe that he has got some preconceived notion about how the very cases in front of him may be resolved. The New York Times also reported then that Alito had flown a second flag outside his beach house in 2023. That was known as the Return to Heaven flag. You recall that well, also in the photography at the time. That originated during the American Revolution, but has more recently been flown by Christian nationalists and, again, Trump supporters on January 6th. All of that indicating that the justice himself may have preconceived notions and biases in favor of those people who believe, without support, that the January 6th, the election was stolen in November, and the January 6th rioters had something legitimate to say about that. We know that Thomas's wife also has drawn some significant controversy over her involvement in her activism. Now, she's got a right to do that. She's got a right to live her own life and pursue her own business, her own political views. But the difficulty and the problem there is that she's supporting efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Her spouse also, like Sam Alito, deciding on those same cases while she's continuing with that advocacy. Among other things, we know that in and around January 6th, Virginia Thomas reaching out to the chief of staff, arguing for an overturning of the 2020 election, all of that also a part of the public domain. Justice Thomas, again, criticized heavily, even before and around the Harlan Crow matters, for failing to recuse himself when indeed he, presumably through his wife, has these views about the 2020 election. We know that Clarence Thomas also never repaid a substantial portion of a loan from a wealthy friend, his name is Anthony Walters, that he used to purchase a luxury RV, $267,000. That was the result of a Senate Finance Committee report, raising questions about whether the loan was properly reported again in his taxes. And as the committee noted, there would be a significant amount of taxable income if the justice, Clarence Thomas, had never paid the principal on the loan, and that income wasn't reported once again on his financial disclosure. This is the RV issue, the $267,000 loan through Anthony Walters there. Thomas, and again, others have other issues out there. Thomas attended at least two donor summits from the Cook Network. This is the political organization founded by billionaire brothers Charles and David Cook. And Thomas, by all reports, participated in a dinner with these high-level donors without disclosing, and this is the problem, without disclosing his appearance at those summits or a private jet trip that he took to and from the event in 2018. Again, problems with not making the disclosures about his connections with these political organizations and their activism. Somewhat similar, New York Times has reported that Thomas has for years benefited, gotten some benefits from a broader cohort of wealthy and powerful friends, some of whom have business before the court, some cases before the court pending, through his membership on the Horatio Alger Society. And that, again, including more luxury travel and a Super Bowl ring, also the subject of public reporting. We know as well from that same reporting that Sam Alito took a fishing trip, a luxury fishing trip, with billionaire Paul Singer, another one of his friends, whose hedge fund had repeatedly had business before the court. Again, this problem with parties appearing in front of the justices when they themselves have these personal engagements with the very parties with whom are involved in these cases, again, without disclosing to the American public those conflicts of interest. He defended that in a Wall Street Journal that came out before this reporting about the luxury fishing trip, claiming that Sam Alito didn't know about Singer's connection to the cases that were pending in front of him in the Supreme Court. And he felt that he would otherwise not have to disclose the trip. He said he flew on Singer's private jet in a seat that would have otherwise been vacant. So no problem, according to Sam Alito. We know as well that Sam Alito is involved in problems, concerns about the decision in a case called Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. Alito drew some attention after the New York Times reported that a conservative activist knew the ruling in that 2014 decision after donors of his had dinner with the justice, and then that sparked another hearing before the House Judiciary Committee in the wake of information suggesting that Sam Alito had disclosed to them the results of that decision before it was made public. All of those things of great concerns. We know as well that they're not exclusive just to these particular justices. We know that Sonia Sotomayor, Neil Gorsuch, and Chief Justice John Roberts, all of them have matters that are perhaps less compelling, but also raise questions about ethics having to do with their own involvement in things beyond the court. These public institutions needing necessarily to be forthright not only in reporting, but also in ensuring that when they do have these conflicts of interest, that they recuse themselves. Why? To ensure the integrity of what they're doing, to give us all confidence that the decisions they make in all these cases are not the product of personal affiliation, personal bias, and personal views about the results even before those cases are decided. As always, we appreciate phone callers and those of you who get in touch with Max and me on the AP, on the Civic Media drop line here. Appreciate callers on a regular basis, and we appreciate this morning Bill calling in to be a part of our discussion here on Amicus. A lot of you. Bill, your question or comment.
Good morning and great topic. You know, we've watched the erosion of the fabric of integrity in our political world in America. It starts at the top with having a guy with 34 felons convictions even having the ability to consider running for president. And then we get to the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court is, number one, out of balance. We don't have equal sides representation. It's lopsided. And now we have a Supreme Court that writes their own rules. I think we have to look at the upcoming election, and hopefully it'll be a push to put integrity back into the fabric of American politics.
Here, here, Bill. Appreciate that commentary here in our broadcast. That's what it's all about. Appreciate so much being a part of our discussion this morning. We're continuing with all of this as Amicus, a law review, continues here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Matt and Air on Air. CBS News Brief. Debbie is finally winding down in the U.S., though heavy rain and flooding have caused devastation along parts of the East Coast. This woman's Pennsylvania home was flooded.
We lost everything down back, swimming pool, kids, swing set, but our house is safe and we're safe. That's all that matters.
An Israeli airstrike on a school in Gaza has killed at least 93 people, though Israel's military says it targeted Hamas militants. CBS's Ramey Innocencio.
Gaza's emergency services said Israel's military dropped three 2,000-pound bombs on the Al-Tabin school and mosque complex in eastern Gaza City, while displaced people who had fled there for shelter were holding early morning prayer.
In Ferguson, Missouri, problems and some progress 10 years after the police killing of Michael Brown. Days of protest raged throughout the country in what became a pivotal moment in the Black Lives Matter movement. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Brewer bats were hot again. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The crew jumped out to an early lead. Two men on base, bottom of the first. Willy Adames at bat on Apple TV.
It's one in the air to deep right field. Fraley is back out near the wall. It's gone. Opposite field, three-run home.
The crew went on to beat the Reds 8-3. A strange start to the night when the new giant $14 million scoreboard in center at AmFam Field went dark and stayed that way. Crews from the manufacturer due in Milwaukee today to try and solve the problem. NFL, the Packers play the Browns this afternoon in Cleveland. Sean Clifford is in his second season with the Pack. As Jordan Love's backup, Clifford asked if he gets nervous before these preseason games.
I think everybody gets nervous. I think they're probably lying if they ever say they do or not. And if they aren't nervous, then I always think that nerves means you care. So I always get a little nervous, but once you're out there, it's back to 11 on 11, and it's just an absolute blast.
That's Packers quarterback Sean Clifford with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine today, highs in the mid-70s, mostly clear tonight, a low around 58. Sunny with a high in the upper 70s on Sunday. 61 Sunday night, partly sunny, 78 the high for Monday. For Tuesday, sunshine with highs near 80 degrees.
Currently 59 degrees.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
This history can't be denied. Wisconsin is the home of the hamburger. About 30 minutes west of Green Bay, you'll find the city of Seymour, where in the 1880s, young Charlie Nagreen pushed his food cart to the fair. The 15-year-old planned to sell round balls of beef to visitors, but it didn't quite catch on. Can you guess the surprising reason why? The answer's coming up. Every summer, the home of the hamburger celebrates its history in a huge way with Burger Fest in Seymour. There's a 200-pound burger on the grill, a bun, run, ketchup slide, and of course, a burger-eating contest. So did you guess why Charlie's first beef recipe didn't work out? Well, as the story goes, visitors to the fair wanted to walk around. Charlie realized he needed to smash his beef ball between two pieces of bread to be able to eat it on the go. Charlie's hamburger, a huge success, making Seymour the home of the hamburger, a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Milwaukee County Board Chairwoman Marcelia Nicholson.
The moment I walked out of the auditorium, I said, it's our time now. It's the little girls that look like me who wake up with brown skin and sometimes wonder, do they matter? To have someone like Kamala, who is not only qualified, but representative of voices that have been ignored for far too long, it felt like all things are possible.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to retired Rear Admiral Joe Seestack about Project 2025's impact on the U.S. military and the state of education in Wisconsin. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. In these final segments of our second hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, turning now from all things United States of America, courts here in our great land, to other things going on overseas, four different countries, Venezuela, Thailand, Great Britain, and Bangladesh. Subject matter is protest happening in all of those nations. Mixed messages coming out of this reporting around the world, certainly underscoring the power of the people to respond to things when they see things in their government and outside of their government with which they do not agree. The importance of advocacy in the public domain, which we also embrace here in the United States of America. The efficacy of those protests in accomplishing some change, trying to get things right if they have gone wrong somehow inside government. The responses of government to protesters, sometimes appropriate, sometimes not. And then also the all-important notion that violence is not a part of the advocacy that we embrace around the world. And yet it is a part of the advocacy that some engage in. And as we'll see in at least two, if not three of these nations, we've got an awful lot of people who are resorting to violence to try to change things as a part of their protests. Lots of different messages to come out of this, but focusing in our last segments here upon reporting around the world about the importance of protests that are nonviolent as a way of ensuring that people have a role in deciding their future, their government, and ensuring that government itself is consistent with their views. Let's begin in Venezuela. You know this story well. An overwhelming set of evidentiary support for the notion that the declared victor, Nicolas Maduro, in the Venezuelan election for the presidency there, did not in fact win that position. In a statement just recently, U.S. Secretary of State, our nation, Anthony Blinken, said there was overwhelming evidence that Venezuela's opposition, in fact, won the recent presidential election. In a statement, Anthony Blinken said it was clear that Edmundo Gonzalez had won the most votes, despite the incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, declaring a disputed victory. He said this, given the overwhelming evidence, it is clear to the United States, and most importantly, to the Venezuelan people, that Edmundo Gonzalez Urrutia won the most votes in Venezuela's July 28th presidential election. Now, all of this, as you can well imagine, prompts an awful lot of response. People around the world calling for more transparency from the Maduro administration, calling upon Maduro himself to release confirmed information. On recently, the election authority there ratified Maduro's disputed victory, saying he'd won 52% of the votes to Gonzalez's 43 from 97% of the votes that were all overall counted. The Electoral Council there, which is a government-controlled announced that President Maduro had won the election for a third term. This prompting, of course, not only the opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, from expressing outrage, saying that, in fact, her candidate for her party had won the election contrary to what Maduro has been saying, but also prompting protests throughout Venezuela, some of them peaceful, regrettably, some of them violent, even deadly in recent times and recent weeks, recent days. The riot police have fired tear gas, rubber bullets into protesters in Caracas recently. Thousands of people demonstrating there against the announced outcome of the election in that nation. And an awful lot of people saying, like the Secretary of State here, Venezuelans have voted, their votes must count. The people in Venezuela rising up, both in nonviolent and regrettably in violent protest, to contest what the current president has said is a result of that election. Opposition leader Machado, and she is now in hiding because of all this, has called for mass demonstrations as we go forward. She has appealed for help there in Venezuela to the international community, more outreach there as well, saying it is now up to the people of Venezuela and also up to the international community to decide whether to tolerate what she has called an illegitimate government. The people in Venezuela protesting that, protesting the lack of transparency, protesting what even our own Secretary of State has confirmed is not the legitimate result of that election in that nation. Let's go to Thailand, where we're seeing also some very disturbing things. There's a party called the Move Forward Party. It actually won the last election in Thailand. And nonetheless, that party has been dismissed by the establishment government as way too liberal, much too radical, even revolutionary in recent times, coming out of the authorities there, the judicial authorities there in Thailand. This party, the Move Forward Party, scored a stunning victory in the election there just last year. And in the midst of all of that, millions of voters, again, supporting this major reversal, if you will, in years and years of tradition there in Thailand. The old guard, the traditional authorities there in government, reacted swiftly to the results of last year's election. It moved to crush this challenging party, this Move Forward Party. Conservative politicians prevented the Move Forward Party from establishing the prime minister's position and engineered a coalition that kept the party out of power. And just this past week, the major Supreme Court, the Thailand Constitutional Court, disbanded the Move Forward Party there in Thailand over charges of the party's proposals to water down a stringent royal defamation law were actually an attempt to overthrow the monarchy. The 9-member high court there in Bangkok ruled unanimously, and they in particular were focusing on something called lèse majesté, this law in Thailand that makes it a crime to criticize the king or certain members of the family. And as a result of what the Supreme Court there has done, the Constitutional Court has done there in Thailand, this major Move Forward Party that was advancing these very progressive views about what should happen there in Thailand, that party has been ruled unconstitutional by the High Court, prompting once again protests there in Thailand by the people. This party itself had effectively won the election last year over the monarchy, over the military, over the financed elite there in Thailand. And the establishment authorities, again, through the court and other mechanisms, stopping this Move Forward Party from taking the oath of office, going forward and serving in their elected position. The Move Forward's victory at the polls was remarkable a year ago and unexpected, captured a broad array at the time of age groups and religions, all sorts of people, winning in places like Phuket, once a military and conservative stronghold, and Bangkok, the capital, of course, there as well. The party was advancing concepts like legalizing same-sex marriage, establishing a $13 daily minimum wage. It had also rejected the notion of relying upon rich mega donors, relied instead on small donations, had a consistent message throughout its campaign. It would never cooperate with the generals who had seized power in a 2014 coup. And indeed, in the election of just last year, that message, all that messaging had attracted the attention and the overwhelming support of most of Thailand's people, resulting in the election of people who are responsible for the administration of this Move Forward Party would have taken their offices, but for the decision of the military and of the traditional elite there to keep them out, prompting once again, protests there in Thailand over what has happened, catalyzing a wave of anti-present government protests, many young people openly criticizing the king's lavish wealth and other things that have happened in the enforcement, again, of this lèse majesté law that makes it a crime in Thailand to criticize the king or certain members of his family. Again, protests going on there as the people attempt, as they best can do, to wrestle government into their own hands in the wake of an election that plainly put the people in charge through this Move Forward Party. More of that going on in Thailand as well. Then we go indeed to Great Britain itself. Great Britain. Also, the focus in some cities, multiple towns across England, Northern Ireland, some violent protests there in England. Breaking out there, and again, as a part of the riots that are happening in some places, 15 towns and cities there. As a result of that, again, a great concern about the future safety and security of those places in Great Britain. What is the reason for this violent unrest in these places in England and Northern Ireland? Well, it's all premised upon an animosity toward migrants. Anti-migrant riots
being developed by people who are anti-immigrant in Great Britain and organizing them in a way that produces not just advocacy, but also violence. These particular outbreaks, these violent arrests, were the product of some disinformation on social media. When have we seen that before? Disinformation there in Great Britain, other places. Online influencers there in Great Britain opposed to immigration, anti-migrant positions, spread a false claim that an asylum seeker there in Great Britain had killed three children in Southport, England, and called their supporters to attend protests against the supposed threat that wasn't real. Many of these gatherings then erupted into violence there in these various towns and other places in England, in North Island. More far-right protesters were expected, but they didn't completely materialize. Instead, thousands of anti-racism protesters gathered in cities across the country. Those protests, again, opposing those people who would be in opposition to immigration in Great Britain. A number of politicians and pundits from the anti-immigration right, while condemning the violence itself, have nonetheless claimed that the unrest is evidence that immigration needs to be restricted, even though it arose on this false online proposition that prompted the violence in the first place. A fellow named Nigel Farage, who you may have seen in the media, newly elected to Parliament there in Great Britain, issued a statement consistent with that. He said that while the violence itself is to be denounced, nonetheless, this mass uncontrolled immigration has fractured communities across our nation. He said that Parliament should be recalled to have a more honest debate and give people the confidence that there are political solutions out there. And indeed, while that is his view articulated in the public domain, the reality is that there are protesters against that position that understand that immigration is in many ways the lifeblood not only of our nation, but also of Great Britain, that this anti-immigration view is not one that is consistent with the laws and the rule of law there in Great Britain. Immigration, in fact, is, while it's a frequent political flashpoint in the country, as it is in ours as well, it's been a notable success in Great Britain. Children of immigrants to Britain tend to be better off financially than their parents. Not true of many immigrant communities in France and Germany, other places on the face of the planet. And we also know that studies show that immigrants are net positive overall for the British economy. Students from the families of Asian and African origins perform better on average in the main national high school exams than white British students do. British cities are also less segregated than those in the United States, and studies suggest that those segregation levels are falling because of the good things that come from immigration. All of that being advocated for, information be provided by protesters against violence that has erupted in Britain that opposes immigration and that would identify immigrants and migrants to the country as a source of problems there. The reaction to the rioting may, in fact, be negative in many, many ways in the left and on the right itself. We'll see how all this plays out. But the reality is that, once again, protests going on in Great Britain about the importance of immigration and this unsupported sense that somehow immigration is contrary to the best interests of the nation. Some of that, regrettably, becoming violent in Great Britain, in these various states and other locations around the country. All of that, a part of the present experience in Great Britain. We know as well that this continues in other places around the nation, and that includes in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh as well, after the recent fleeing of the prime minister, her name is Sheikh Hasina. She recently fled just this past week after a violent crackdown of hers failed to quell a national movement against her own government. Thousands of protesters on the streets in Bangladesh. We're going to talk about that in our final segment here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Shaw WAUK. Get ready, Waukesha. Here comes Y2K, your 2000s tribute band straight out of Chicago, playing all the hits from the dawn of a new millennium. Join us on August 13th at the beautiful Frame Park Amphitheater located at 1240 Frame Park Drive for Tribute Tuesday. From 7 to 9 p.m., Y2K will be rocking the stage with all of your favorite 2000 anthems from the Backstreet Boys, Blink-182, Destiny's Child, Taylor Swift, Carly Rae Jepsen, Shania Twain, Pink, Miley Cyrus, Fall Out Boy, and more. It's an outdoor concert, so don't forget to bring the lawn chairs and blankets to kick back and enjoy the show. Mark your calendars and join us for an unforgettable evening of music, memories, and fun. That's Y2K at Frame Park Amphitheater, 1240 Frame Park Drive on August 13th from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
If you can't make it in person, hear the entire show live on 540 a.m. WAUK, starting at 7 p.m. Sponsored by the Waukesha Parks Rec and Forestry Department.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is Amicus Law Review, and this is our final segment. We're talking, again, about protests across the globe, some of them positive, some of them advancing change, advocating for change inside and outside government, other protests turning violent. Never a part of the way of accomplishing that change, but unless we're seeing that as forces on all sides of issues clash in the streets of our major nations on the face of this planet. Bangladesh, no exception to that ugliness, and all of this prompted by the recent fleeing of the prime minister. His name is Sheikh Hasina. She recently fled Bangladesh after a violent crackdown that she had animated, her own violent crackdown, an attempt to try to stop protesters in that nation. It failed to quell, to stop a nationwide movement against her government, against these protesters, against her. She flees. And as thousands of protesters celebrated her ouster in the wake of all of this activity, reports began to surface there in Bangladesh of an emerging retaliation against Hasina's party. It's called the Awami League. And against also some of her allies, including the Hindu minority there in Bangladesh. And that's what this story is all about. That while protests of a government there resulting in the fleeing of the prime minister, perhaps do in fact take the public's temperature and do in fact accomplish what a majority of the public there wants to see in its own government. Nonetheless, a retaliation against those people who would take an opposite view, a violent retaliation now apparently underway against Hindus in Bangladesh, cannot be the way forward. In addition to the party's offices, Awami League's offices, homes of its members, rioters just recently in Bangladesh have targeted Hindus, torching their homes, vandalizing temples, and fears of attacks, more attacks amplified. And in the absence of a government now that the prime minister has fled, law enforcement retreating from sight in many parts of the country. In addition to the almost 300 people killed during the government crackdown that precipitated all of this, that also a part of the unrest there in Bangladesh, at least 60 people have now been killed in the violence that erupted in the wake of all that in Muslim-majority Bangladesh. Reliable details about the attackers and victims are not immediately available. We don't know about the dimension of this, but we do know that there were attacks on homes of Hindus and their temples in at least four districts of Bangladesh, again, based upon their notion that they are somehow supporting the now-fled prime minister, and for that reason should be the focus of terror there. Inappropriate response. Villages in Chattogram, the country's second most populous city, according to witnesses, relatives of people whose properties were targeted, very, very commonplace. Student groups that led the protesters against Ms. Hasina have acknowledged the violence, suggested their own supporters have not been involved in this, but others have confirmed that temples are being attacked, vandalized, and looted. One of the organizations out there that is responding to this has condemned it plainly, noting not only that this is not the way that protesters should pursue their own views, not to take it out on a particular minority group, in this case, Hindus in Bangladesh. And the president of Bangladesh himself, who holds a modestly ceremonial role just this past week, has now appointed a Nobel Peace Prize, a Nobel
Peace Prize-winning microfinance pioneer. His name is Muhammad Yunus, to lead an interim government in the wake of the departure of the former Prime Minister Hasina. And the members of that interim government are expected to take their position within just days. But in the meantime, some of the retaliation against Hindu populations there by protesters and others who may be happy to see the departure of the former government, but nonetheless responding in a way that is inappropriate, illegal, contrary to the human rights and civil rights of Hindu populations in Bangladesh. Restoring law and order will therefore be one of the principal focuses of the new interim government coming in the immediate future. In the course of all of this, the director of Asia at Human Rights Watch had described all these reports against Hindus as extremely concerning. Hindus, he reported, are apparently being attacked because they traditionally supported the former prime minister, the Awami League Party. Bangladeshis came out on the streets to demand an end to authoritarianism, and these attacks that followed their just demand for human rights are equally inappropriate, as we see them exhibited in other places on the face of the planet. Tensions between Muslims and Hindus in Bangladesh have boiled over in the past, including violent clashes in the country in 2021. Very complicated situation emerging there in Bangladesh as a government attempts to take over, to restore peace, some sense of government there in that nation. In the meantime, protests that can in fact be civil and can in fact be peaceable, to celebrate in some segments the removal of the Hasani government, but also protests that have turned ugly, resulting in deaths and condemnations and violence visited upon some members of the population there, Hindu in their faith. Continuing to focus on all of that as we think about the significance of protests of an appropriate nature and those that are not. As always, listeners and callers here on Amicus Law Review, a part of our discussion, appreciative, Jack, of your involvement this weekend in our discussion here on our broadcast. Calling in from Merrimack, Jack, your comment or question.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say thanks for taking over while Maggie Dawn was on.
Absolutely. Glad to be here for 3 days this past week. Lots of material covered, lots of things to talk about. Again, the area of rule of law and justice just the past couple of days. Thanks for that comment, Jack. I appreciate it. And Jack, are you still there? All right, Jack, if you're still there, we'd be appreciative of your thoughts and comments, as we always do here on Amicus Law Review. We are concluding now our two-hour presentation, our discussion here of all things justice-related. A programming note for the future: the next program coming up in about 1 week from now, going to focus again not only upon some international stories, but also things coming out of our appellate courts in our lands. We've chatted from time to time about major decisions that are percolating up, coming up from the lower courts, the district courts, and including various issues that are going to reach the Supreme Court ultimately. One of those that we're going to talk about next week is a major case coming out of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals just this past week, upholding a Maryland ban on assault weapons, invoking much of the language of the decision by the Supreme Court in Heller, also in Bruin, that says, yes, indeed, you can impose restrictions on gun access in America. We're going to talk more about guns next week as well. Join us for that discussion. Be a part of our discussion here on Amicus Law Review. And have a good week, everybody. Take care.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK. Pete Schwabba.
I'm on vacation this week, so for tonight's episode, we will bring you some of my favorite moments from previous Nightlight episodes. I'll be back and ready to light it up again on August 19th.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Wisconsin's fall primary election is Tuesday, August 13th, with constitutional ballot questions, a U.S. Senate race, contested congressional primaries, and new legislative maps. This fall, Wisconsin decides.
Be a voter? Then tune to your local Civic Media radio station for coverage you won't find anywhere else.
I'm News Director Terry Bell. When the polls close at 8, our news team will bring you results from all over Wisconsin.
Election coverage live, Tuesday, August 13th at 8.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the app. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.